So if you missed last week, we flew in Matt Chandler from the United States via a flash drive. It was great to have him. And he did an overview of the first 15 chapters of Exodus, and it's powerful. And he was just making the point, which is so helpful for us, that to take little bits and pieces of the Bible and kind of read them in isolation gives us this kind of mottled understanding of the Bible that's actually phenomenally unhelpful. And he was looking at Exodus chapter 1 all the way through to chapter 15 and looking at kind of the meta-narrative or the overarching story of Exodus, those first 15 chapters. And so today, we're going to dive down a little bit more into some of the detail in Exodus chapter 1. But if you missed last week, I really want to encourage you, in the newsletter, there's a link to it. Or just ask anybody that was here, one of the leaders, and we'll be able to give you a link to that Matt Chandler overview. And it's so helpful to ground you and root you in what we're going to be doing. In the next 8 or 9 weeks, I think it is, we're doing Exodus up to chapter 15. Then we're going to take a break, and towards the end of the year, we're going to come back again and look at the latter part of Exodus. And you might be thinking, well, why in the world are we doing this Old Testament book? Hands up. Anyone honest enough to say you've never read Exodus? Now, who's read Exodus? Hands up, who's read Exodus? Okay, so then that's a nicer way to do it, all right? But what in the world are you preaching about this book? It's like so old, it's like 2,000 years old, it's written for this people, Israel, and it's like it's out of context for us. What's going on? And I'm hoping that as we begin to unfold this series, you're going to begin to see the striking parallels to our lives today. I'm hoping that starts right now today as we look at the story of the slaves in Exodus, and there's five major themes that we're going to be picking up through the book of Exodus. The first theme is the presence of God. Exodus starts with this beautiful, in the first couple of chapters, where God says, I will be your God, and you will be my people, and I will dwell with you. And God comes and he reminds us that he wants to be present with us. This is the first major theme in Exodus. The second major theme in Exodus is that God is a God who keeps his promises. He's a God who promised to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob. Those are the forefathers of the Israelite nation. And here in Exodus, we see that God says, I will not forget my promise. He's a God who keeps his promises. The third theme that we'll be looking at is the theme of salvation and the theme of redemption. These are big Christian words, but salvation is an obvious one. You're drowning in the sea and you're shouting, save me! That's you asking for salvation. That's what it is. Redemption was literally a slavery word. It was a word that means that Otto is a slave to Luke, and he's in like bondage to Luke. And Otto's dad comes and says to Luke, what can I pay you to redeem my son? Redemption is a gospel word. It's a payment word. And he would come and pay Luke, maybe give him Dean instead. And then Otto would be free. His not so loved son, his second son. But Exodus is where we begin to see this major, major theme of the scriptures beginning to be expounded, and this theme of salvation and redemption from the enemy. Redemption from slavery. Then the fourth major theme is this theme of sacrifice. What's with all the blood and all the lambs being killed and all the Passover and painting lamb's blood on your door and all of this stuff? And we, you know, Christians will say, I'm covered by the blood of the lamb. And all the unbelievers are like, eh? Say what? And often we don't even understand what that means. And as we understand the metaphor and what God is doing in Exodus, it begins to make some of the gospel language so much clearer. But that salvation, so the sacrifices, that salvation comes through the life of someone else. We don't have to give our lives for our salvation. And then the last one is maybe the most exciting one, and it almost works like a seal on top of the first four. The last one is the theme of God's power. When we grasp that God is all-powerful, when you read the book of Exodus and you see that God goes against the laws of nature, every single miracle that he does, every plague that he brings, he's like, turn the Nile water into blood. It's my Nile River. Killing the firstborn sons. Yes, we can get there in the horrors of that. But he's saying, I give life. Making the water stand up on the side of the sea as the Israelites go through it. He's saying, it's my sea. And the beauty and the power of this fifth theme of God's power is if God is that powerful that we claim, if God is as powerful as we claim, then you go back to theme number one, and isn't God's presence all the sweeter? That this powerful God would dwell among us? Isn't God's promises so much more beautiful, so much more steadfast? If my little two-year-old boy promises me something and Bill Gates promises me something, which one is greater? Which one am I going to rely on more? If Bill Gates says I'm going to give you 3 million rand and my little son says I'm going to give you 3 million rand. I'm going to rely on Bill Gates' promise. If we understand that God is powerful to do what he says he can do, man, his promises become huge. His salvation becomes sure. His redemption is flooding our lives and his sacrifice. And we're going to get to these things in the weeks to come. So this morning we're going to be predominantly in theme chapter 1, the theme of God's presence. And the cry from Exodus chapter 1 is, God, where are you? Anybody feel like that this morning? God, where are you? And let's read this. We're going to read from verse 8. Now, there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph, and he said to his people, behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. Therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramesses. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad. And the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. So they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves, and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and bricks, and in all kinds of work in the field. In all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves. Then the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah and the other Puah, when you serve as midwife to the Hebrew woman and see them on the birth stool, if it is a son, you shall kill him. But if it is a daughter, she shall live. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the male children live. So the king of Egypt called the midwives and said to them, why have you done this and let the male children live? The midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife comes to them. So God dealt well with the midwives. And the people multiplied and grew strong, grew very strong. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, every son that is born to the Hebrews, you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live. The temptation when we read a text like this is to sanitize the text, to read it in a kind of detached way, like it happened to this people generations and generations and generations ago. When you actually begin to drill down into what's going on in Exodus chapter 1, this is a handbook on genocide. This is an extermination handbook. It's like 101 genocide that's going on in Exodus chapter 1. It's how to eradicate a nation. And Pharaoh begins to you'll see these different steps that he puts in place to get rid of this Israel problem. There's an Israelite problem. And so the first thing that you see is in verse chapter 9, in chapter 1, verse 9 and 10, and he said to the people, behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. This is Pharaoh talking. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them. Now watch what he does. Lest they multiply, and if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. Pharaoh begins quite tamely with political shrewdness. He knows that if he can begin a narrative of fear among the Egyptian people, they're going to be more than willing to do what he wants to do down the line. But he starts with this political shrewdness, this narrative of fear. He says, if we don't do something about the subset of people, if we don't do something about the Israel problem, they're multiplying, they're getting bigger, they're going to take all our jobs. They're going to take our land. And he begins to churn out this fear in the hearts of his people. He says, your very nation, Egypt, your nation is in danger if we don't get rid of these people. Let's oppress them, lest they multiply. Your way of life is going to change. And suddenly all the Egyptians feel under threat from the nation Israel. Does this ring any bells, South Africans? Anyone? Does this ring any bells? some of the conversations that we're part of, going to Australia because of this and this and this, this country's going to the dogs, and all the fear-mongering that goes on at our bras. Some of the history of our land, some of the political shrewdness that's going on right now, our politicians using fear to stir up the masses against one another for their own political gains. But then in verse 13 and 14, we see Pharaoh change to second gear. And he goes from this political narrative, this shrewdness, and he moves to more overt oppression of the people. And it says in verse 13, "So they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in all kinds of work in the fields. In all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves." The word ruthless is a violent word. It's an oppression word. What happens here is legalized, sanctioned oppression of people. I believe there are few things that rob a people of their dignity more than legalized oppression. When there's no one to call, when there's an act being done against you, and those in power have said that that act is okay. Can you imagine the hopelessness that begins to set into the hearts of these people being enslaved? How desperately they scan the horizon for help, but help doesn't come. Not through the justice systems, not through the law enforcement agencies. Justice doesn't come. Does this ring any bells, anybody? And then Pharaoh changes into third gear, and he goes from this oppression to manipulative, secret manipulation of the people. And he goes to the Hebrew midwives. Think of the sickness of what he's doing here. These are the women who are there to help people give birth. They are the Hebrew midwives who are there in that woman's moment of need as she's giving birth for them to come and help her. And he says, in your position, you murder the sons. You kill the sons on fear of their own lives. Those midwives were told to murder the sons. Verse 15, and the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah and the other Puah, when you serve as midwives to the Hebrew woman and see them on the birthstool, if it is a son, you shall kill him. But if it is a daughter, she shall live. Why is it okay to keep the daughters? What do you think that Pharaoh is trying to do? I think Pharaoh, we see this. We see this today in modern genocides. You eradicate a nation by taking out the boys and raping the girls and breeding out the Israelite nation. I'm taking the sanitized glasses off the text. I know it's rough, but this is what is happening. If we can kill all the boys in one generation, we will eradicate the nation of Israel. This is his third plan, because his other plans are not working. His oppression is not working. See, this is horrific. This is when the back corridor conversations, the narrative has been stirred up. This narrative of fear has been so stirred up that Pharaoh feels that he can broach the topic of extermination. It's the same corridors that happened in, it's the same conversations that happened in the back corridors of Hitler's Germany. The Jewish problem. We see it here all the way back in Exodus chapter 1. The Israelite problem. It's the same conversation that happened in Rwandan homes. It's the same conversation. Do you know that in the last 100 years, nine of the most devastating genocides have happened out of 10. Nine out of 10 of the most devastating genocides have happened in the last 100 years. We ain't getting more civilized. And then Pharaoh moves into his final gear and he moves to all-out genocide. All his plans are not working. The Hebrew midwives defy him and give him an excuse which he buys. But verse 22, the last verse in chapter 1, then Pharaoh commanded all his people, Every son that is born to the Hebrews you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live. So now the gloves really come off. Now the propaganda and the narrative that Pharaoh has been running out among his people has so taken root in the hearts of the individual Egyptians. It's not just Pharaoh driving this anymore. Now he says, you can go and grab a little baby boy and throw him in the Nile. Sanctioned, legalized murder. Can you imagine the herald comes to your town with the script from Pharaoh, the most powerful power known to earth at that time, the most powerful kingdom. Thus says Pharaoh, you can take these little baby boys, screaming infants away from their mothers, and no one can lift a finger against you. It's like, oh God, can you imagine this? I'm going to get to the hope part just now. But as we read the text this morning, I hope that some of what we are going through resonates with some of what the Israelites are going through. But I'm pretty sure that nobody in this room could say, I have it that bad. And as we look at God's rescue act over the next few weeks, as we look at God rescuing these people out of this shocking situation, I hope that it fuels a hope in our hearts that our God is strong, that our God can heal us and deliver us from whatever it is that we are facing. But maybe in some way this morning, your heart, you resonate with some of the trials and the troubles. Maybe no one else in this room knows what you're going through. I know Mother's Day is a beautiful, joyful day for most of us, and I don't want to rob any of that away, but I know that there's people sitting here this morning for whom this is a tough day. This is not an easy day. People who've had an abortion and think of the child that could have been. By God's grace, we are forgiven, yes, but we still live with that thought. People here who've lost moms. Helena, we're praying for you this week, a year on from the death of your mom. And we think of people who've lost children, the Bereshes and others like that, who today is a sad, devastating day. Maybe that's some of the trouble that you face. Maybe you've grown up in a home where you were abandoned, or maybe there was divorce and you were ripped apart from moms and from dads, and there's a brokenness. Maybe today you're struggling with depression, with suicidal thoughts, or like the Israelites were enslaved in the land of Egypt, you're struggling with slavery and addiction. It could be a situation that's been forced onto you. Rape, molestation, a family financial crisis, racism. And you sit there this morning and you say, Paul, if only you could see inside of me, you'd see the chains. I'm not being physically whipped by a taskmaster. I'm not being chased down by an Egyptian. But man, every day I wake up and I am beaten. Every day I am whipped by my circumstances. And I'm reminded of what happened X number of years ago. The other question maybe that rears its head in this text in Exodus is, where are you, God? And many of us, how many of us have not at some point in our lives cried out, God, where are you? Where are you in the cancer, God? Where are you in the divorce? Where are you in the death of this person? Where are you in my friendship circles and my loneliness, God? And we feel deserted and abandoned by God. And we even went and got Footprints. Do you remember Footprints? The poem, you know, with the one. And we read that because that normally cheers us up. And there's only like one set of footprints in the sand, and that's where God carried you. But even that didn't cheer you up. And it's like, God, where are you? Or maybe the text brings out a secret doubt in our hearts. Do you know that it's okay to doubt, Christians? I just want to set some people free here this morning. Do you know that it's okay to doubt? Sometimes that's seen as like the unforgivable sin in churches, like you're doubting God. But maybe part of that doubt is that deep down you're not actually that sure whether God is more powerful than Pharaoh. You're not actually that sure whether God can defeat what he says he can defeat. You look at other people and you hear them stand up and give a testimony and you're like, you can get, God can help you with that thing, but me, I'm broken beyond repair. And you doubt the strength and the power of God, and or you come to Christ under this prosperity gospel crap, pardon me, but that's the best word for it. And your problems are meant to be ratcheting down. But you come to God and your problems are ratcheting up. And you say, God, where's this power I was told about? Where's this life full of joy I was told about? You're like, God, it's supposed to be going the other way. And friends, Pharaoh is scary. In our lives, Pharaoh is strong. Pharaoh is devastating as he roars over lives. Even here this morning, every family, every marriage, every relationship, look down, you'll see the bite marks of Pharaoh on your leg. You'll see the bite marks of the enemy. He goes into every sphere of our lives. We don't become Christians and put like a necklace and it's like a lucky charm that keeps us away from trouble and keeps us away from Satan biting us on the leg. Are you still with me? But Exodus will help us to understand that God has a plan. Exodus will help us to see, and as we look at the overarching story of what God begins to do with this people, Israel, it's a story of what God wants to do in our lives. It's an echo, a pre-echo of the gospel and what God comes to do in our hearts. And as we grow in understanding of God's word, we'll say, God, I don't understand what I'm going through right now, but I know that there's a bigger picture. I know that your word says that all things, the death of a child, all things, cancer, all things, divorce, all things, bankruptcy, all things work together for the good of those who love him. Wow, what a comfort. And so I want to parallel Pharaoh and his enslavement of the Israelites with the enemy, the devil, Satan, call it what you will, and his oppression and slavery over us as people. And I want to pull out a few things that this enemy, the devil, will always do in our lives. I'm going to look at Exodus chapter 1, and I want to pull out just four things that he's always going to do that we need to watch for. Number one, he lives to destroy our inheritance and our future. Do you know that God has a future for you believers? Do you know that if you don't know Jesus this morning, that he has a future, a preferred future for you, whether you believe it or not? Verse 22, then Pharaoh commanded all his people, every son that is born to the Hebrews you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live. For Israel, this was the culmination of his extermination plan. That's a nice word, phrase, a culmination of an extermination plan. I like that. But this was his culmination of the plan against the Israelites. Kill all the baby boys, breed them out, get rid of them. You don't want to see them as a nation. But for us, he's saying, you think you have a future? You think you have a future in the land? No, you don't. He comes and says this stuff in our ears. He lives to destroy the longevity of God's people. You want to make it to the finish line, and he's waiting the whole time. Traps, 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 trying to catch us along the way. He lives to destroy our inheritance and our future. Telling you you've been overlooked. Telling you you're not good enough. Secondly, he lives to try and make us look like the world. As I've referenced a number of times, Israel, he was trying to breed them out by killing the boys. And for us, we have to constantly face this fight that he comes and tells us that the uniqueness that God wants to create in us, a people set apart for himself, a people who look distinct to God, a people who have a culture that's separate from the world's culture, he comes and says, mash, make it look the same. He says, you're not set apart, don't be daft. You're just like everybody else. He wants to make us look like the world, divorce like the world, sleep together before we married like the world, do business and our tax returns like the world. He wants to make us look just like the world. He wants us to talk like the world, to gossip and slander and use foul language just like the world. He wants us to raise our children like the world. consumerist little kids running around pulling stuff off the shelves. He wants us to have marriages breaking down like the world. Do you know that there's no difference between the divorce rate in church and out of church? Isn't that a shocking statistic? He wants to make us look just like the world. He wants us to spend our money like the world. Until one day, perhaps only as we step onto eternity's shores and we look back on our lives, will we look and be shocked that there's barely a flicker of difference between the way that we lived our lives and those who didn't know Jesus lived their lives. If He can keep us there, if the enemy can keep us there, that's what He's going for. And number three, or is it three or four, whichever one it is, He sows fear and division among us. Verse 9, "Behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land." And so for Israel, the narrative that Pharaoh was talking through was this narrative of fear that left people hating the Israelites so much that they were prepared to engage in a genocide against this nation. For us, as He comes to sow this fear and this division in our hearts, have you ever noticed that it's normally quite easy to do stuff alone? As soon as you add someone else into the mix, that's when the problems begin to come along. I've never met a single person who thought marriage was tough. I've never met a single person or a married person without kids who didn't think that parenting was easy. We all know exactly what it's like until we walk that road. You see, because we default to this creeping sin inside of our heart, which leads to issues with one another. We wire that way because of our sin. And the devil comes and runs rampant on that trampoline in our hearts. He loves to come and sow insecurity, sow fear, sow doubt. And so you're a person of color here this morning and he tells you you'll never fit in. He comes and whispers that lie. He says they will never understand you. They'll never get it. They'll never accept you. Or you're here this morning and you're struggling with personal insecurity and he's so quick on the draw, isn't he? It's like those gunslingers. He's so quick on the draw, telling you that no one loves you here, that you're lonely for a reason, that nobody wants you. And the fourth thing that the enemy will always, always try and do is his ultimate goal is our destruction and extermination. 1 Peter 5 verse 8, this powerful verse, it says, speaking to Christians, it says, "Be sober-minded, be watchful. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour." You're not sure of that language, go on YouTube, a lion devouring something. He prowls around, listen to the language, seeking someone to devour. And as that lion gets into that carcass and there's blood all over his face and his mane, and he breaks the bones as he's going through and his claws are in that, that is the image that Peter is saying of the devil wants to do in our lives. He doesn't want to play with you like a little cat playing with a little ball of string. He wants to devour. A friend of mine told me this story from a book that he was reading. He was reading, I think it's the 1960s or 70s, a game ranger in the Kruger National Park. And he would take his wife, and he's got two little daughters, and he would take them out regularly and do picnics and whatever else in the middle of the Kruger. And he took them out one day for a picnic, and they put out the blanket, and him and his wife were getting the food ready, and the two daughters ran off up this little koppie. And the next minute, he heard the scream from his daughters. And so this father just sprinted as fast as he could. And as he got up to the top of this koppie, there were his two girls, and this male lion was busy approaching them. This is a true story. And the father sprinted and got in between the lion and his two girls. And he said this phrase, and I'm trying my best Afrikaans, "Staan terug, dochterkie, staan terug. Stand back, daughters. Stand, baie goed, dankie. Stand back, daughters. Stand back." And that father stood between this pacing oncoming male lion and these two daughters. And he scared it off with a stick and chased this lion away. And he's writing his memoirs from the Kruger National Park. And friends, yes, Pharaoh is powerful. The enemy we face is powerful. And he roars over our lives to devour us, is the language of Peter. But God hears our scream, and he runs up the hill, and he stands between us and this lion that is pacing towards us, roaring over us, wanting to devour us. And he says, "Stand back, daughters. Stand back. Stand back, sons. Stand back. I've got this." And he sends Jesus, his son, in our place. How many could come up today from you guys? How many could come up and give a testimony of the truth of what I'm busy sharing? That while we've been faithless, while we've been wallowing in faithlessness, God has proved himself faithful. While we have been weak and broken, we have found God to be strong. While we have been wallowing in sorrow and trouble that comes with our life, God has poured new life and freshness and joy into our hearts. That while we have deserved death, and the more I get to know him, the more I realize how filthy I am, that instead he gives us life. This is a beautiful thing. I don't want to give the devil one piece of credit more than what he needs. I don't think I've ever preached on the devil. I hate speaking about him. But man, we need to understand that there is a lion that seeks to devour us. And so I want to finish by saying, well, how does God respond to this lion? How does God respond to the pharaohs in our lives? And the first thing is so obvious, but he sends Jesus. Next week, JB is going to be preaching on the next section in Exodus. And JB is preaching on this title as Wanted, a Deliverer. And we're going to be look at the deliverance that Moses brings to the people of Israel, but parallel it with what Jesus does to us. And I want to read you a text out of Hebrews chapter 12. It says, "Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and the sin which clings so closely." Anybody else sin cling close? Everywhere I turn, it's like a shadow. "And the sin that clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us." Just now I was talking about the inheritance that God has for us, the future plans that the Pharaoh comes to want to destroy. We want to run that race with endurance, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider Jesus, who endured from sinners such hostility against him, so that you, say me, so that you, Bates, so that you, Dill, so that we may not grow weary or faint-hearted. In your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. In other words, it's not so bad. Jesus has done more. How does God respond to the Pharaoh in our lives? He sends us Jesus, who doesn't just come and give us some moral support and come and give us a few doctrines to live by, but who says, "I've done it. I've suffered. I know what it is." You think you're going through the worst trial. You're going through the worst trial. Whatever it is you face, Jesus can say, "I've been there." And we look to Jesus, and as it says in the text, "Consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself, that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted." Friends, are you weary? Are you faint-hearted? I want to encourage you this morning. Look to Jesus. Look to Jesus. Secondly, he reminds us that he is with us, even when we feel that he is not. Our feelings are a notoriously poor barometer. I'm going to ruin the end of the story here for you if you haven't read Exodus. But Exodus starts off with how many people coming into Egypt? Anyone know from chapter 1? I think it's chapter 1, 6 or 7, somewhere around there. 5. All the descendants of Jacob were 70 persons. How many people left Egypt? You can find it in Exodus chapter 12. 600,000 men, not counting women and children. 600,000 men. And what is it? So I'm getting somewhere with this, right? I'm telling you about why he reminds us that he's with us even when we don't know, we don't feel it, that he's with us. So you have these 70 people that enter Egypt. Then you have a Pharaoh who is hell-bent on what? Exterminating them. What's Pharaoh's problem? He says, come, verse 10, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. He's trying to stop them from multiplying. And then twice in chapter 1, we read God's response. The Pharaoh's great concern is that people multiply. And God says in verse 12, but the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied. Exactly what Pharaoh is trying to shut down, God is there doing the opposite. As they are oppressed, the more they multiplied and the more they spread abroad. And then as Pharaoh ratchets through the gears to exterminating these people, Israel, in verse 20, right at the end, it says, so God dealt well with the midwives and the people multiplied and grew very strong. And so right in the midst of Pharaoh trying to destroy this nation, God is there, multiplying, multiplying, multiplying. See, the story of the Israelites should fill us with a great and enduring hope. Whatever you're facing today, is it worse than this? Is the God who was able to save and deliver these people from the most horrible of circumstances, is he not able to do the same for you? Is he not able to do the same for me? You may face the deepest despair, the most tragic situation, the most broken of backgrounds, the most terrible of circumstances that have been pushed into your life. But Exodus stands as this incredible reminder that God is present. Even when we don't feel him, see him, or know it, he is present to rescue. Exodus is a huge smack in the teeth for the prosperity gospel. Man, the prosperity gospel wants to come and say that we should have comfort and ease when everything in the Bible, if you have an honest read of your Bible, I don't know where you can find the prosperity gospel. Jesus, in this life you will have trouble, but take heart, I have overcome the world. We take heart not because we're driving a Ferrari, not because we're living in a mansion, we take heart because Christ has overcome the world. See, God's saying his plan is sovereign, but he's not your butler. God is not your butler. God is not your vending machine. You put your prayer in. You put your tithe in. You put a bit of time in. You open your home up a little bit and out pops a Ferrari. This is not the God we serve. But this is what's being peddled on TV. This is what's being peddled. And your children will never die. You'll never face any tragedy. And we treat God like this puppet on a string. Friends, it can fill us with enduring hope, but we must know that God's plan is sovereign. That his hand does not follow the river the way we want his hand to follow the river. That the paths he leads us in are not the paths that we would necessarily choose because we're so limited in our own understanding of his plan. Thirdly, how does God respond to Pharaoh in our lives? God plants us in loving community. This is where I want to end this morning. I want to issue a warning, and you hear this morning, which is awesome, but maybe you're not here that often. But you step out of community at your peril. When you step out of, and I'm not just talking about coming to a meeting, I'm talking about actually getting involved in meaningful community in such a way that Gustav knows me and I know Gustav. In such a way that you've got people around you that you know and they know you. When you step out of that, you do so at your own peril. I want to warn you, those who are community light. Now you get like Coca-Cola, then you get Coca-Cola light. Some of us are like community light. You know, there's no sugar. We just come when we feel like it. We hardly know anybody and no one knows us. You are walking in the open plain, and I want to remind you that a lion is roaring, seeking someone to devour. He plants us in loving community. And that story of the game ranger, that picture for me of the roaring lion is so powerful. And I wonder if this morning there's people here whose lives are being roared over by the enemy. You're being roared over by the enemy. Maybe it's financial. Maybe it's eating disorders. Maybe it's loneliness and you feel completely alone. You know, I'm realizing more and more in this town, Stellenbosch, as I get to know it, how many lonely students there are here. Desperately lonely. It could be the roar of addiction. Pornography. Can I say that in church? Do you know that pornography is not just a man issue anymore? The statistics are showing that women are struggling hugely with pornography. Drugs, secret alcoholism. Maybe just your wife or just your husband knows about it. Addictions to eating or not eating, gambling, or even compulsive spending. All these things. Grace, where are you, Gracie? Somewhere. So helpfully came to me at the end of our prayer time. We were praying. Bates was leading prayer and was speaking into addictions and speaking about God wanting to break things over us. So helpfully came and reminded me that so often addiction goes hand in hand with shame. We're embarrassed. On the outside, it looks like everything's okay, but we've got the secret sin festering in our lives. Friends, God plants us in loving community so that we can stand together. I wonder if God, this is practical, I wonder if God is calling some of us to stand in the gap for our brothers and sisters whom the enemy is roaring over. I don't mean just the spiritual version of that, like, yes, I'll pray for you, I'll stand in the gap for you, I'll pray for you, which we should do too. But I mean, if you know someone who is financially desperate here today, who has a few hundred rand left in their bank account and doesn't know what to do, maybe could I ask you to suspend some of your judgment in terms of why they don't have money and how they should have looked after their savings better or whatever the case may be. Could we as a community, a loving community where God has placed people in, silence the roar of the devil over that person's life? When we face financial issues, the lion can roar so loudly that we can't hear anything else. Maybe it's someone that will admit to us in a small group or a life group or one-on-one over a coffee that they have been fighting a battle with pornography. Will you stick your hand up and say, I will walk the road with you. You can phone me at 1 a.m. in the morning when it's inconvenient. We'll go through it over and over and over again. Yes, okay, you did it again. Yes, you did it again. Yes, you did it again. Okay, 5 years later, you did it again. We're going to walk this road and we stick it out with them. Or maybe it's just opening our eyes to see the lion roaring over our community, full of insecurities, full of young men and women who haven't yet learned some of the lessons that some of us older guys have forgotten already. And we just can silence the mouth of the lion just by opening our homes and say, come and be with us. What are you doing for lunch today? Why don't you come and sit with me? Or is our Grand Prix going to win out? Or like, but it's Sunday afternoon. I have a nap. My Sunday afternoon nap. I can't have you in my home. Friends, the lion roars over our lives, but God has placed us in a community that's meant to, in some way, shut the mouth of that lion. I'm really going to ruin the story now, and I'll take you right to the end. Revelations, the last book in the Bible. All the way to 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, who knows when Jesus is coming. The thousands of years between when Exodus is written. Revelation 5 verse 5 says, and one of the elders said to me, this is John, the apostle writing, weep no more. Behold, the lion of the tribe of Judah, the root of David, has conquered. So I want to end today. The lion of the tribe of Judah, which is met. It's the tribes of Israel. If you don't know what that is, that's another Christian phrase. One of the tribes of Judah. One of the tribes of Israel was a tribe called Judah. And David, who was the king, who was the prophetic picture of Christ's coming as the king over his kingdom, was from that tribe. So when it says the tribe of Judah, the root of David, has conquered, it's saying Jesus has conquered. Charles Spurgeon said, God is too good to be unkind, and he is too wise to be mistaken. And when we cannot trace his hand, we must trust his heart. Beautiful. I'm really sensing this morning that we need to respond. I know that's the big scary word, but maybe our musicians can come and we'll sing a worship song together. But I believe there's people here today who don't know Jesus. You've never said yes to him. And maybe some of this stuff scares you and you don't quite know, but something in your heart is saying, yes, I want that. I've got brokenness. I'm a mess, and I want to respond and say, yes, Jesus, I need you in my life. And I want to give you an opportunity to respond. And then I think that there's many, many, many of us sitting here this morning with brokenness, with secret sin, with secret addiction in our lives, who are community light, who check in and check out as we want to, as it's convenient for us. If the weather's bad, we come to church. If the weather's good, we hit the beach. And I just believe God wants to stir and work in our hearts this morning as we respond. Is that all right? So can we stand, shake our limbs, get some air in our lungs, and let's sing a song and then respond to our King.